I hadn't forgotten a word we'd said. And neither had he, though neither one of us had spoken of it again. We weren't walking on tiptoe with each other, but we were feeling our way, finding our way into each other, as we'd done twice before. Once, when I'd returned to find him in Edinburgh, and at the beginning, when we'd found ourselves wed by force and joined by circumstance. Only later, by choice. "What would you have wanted to be?" I asked on impulse, "if you hadn't been born the Laird of Lallybroch?"
"I wasn't. If my elder brother hadn't died, you mean," he said.
A small shadow of regret crossed his face, but didn't linger. He still mourned the boy who had died at 11, leaving a small brother to pick up the burden of leadership and struggle to grow into it. But he had been accustomed to that burden for a very long time. "Maybe that," I said. "But what if you'd been born elsewhere? Maybe to a different family?"
"Well, I wouldn't be who I am then, would I?"
he said logically, and smiled at me.
"I may quibble wi' what the Lord's called me to do now and then, Sassenach, but I've nae argument wi' how he made me."
I looked at what he was, the strong, straight body and capable hands, the face so full of everything he was, and had no argument either.
"Besides," he said, and tilted his head consideringly, "if it had been different, I wouldn't have you, would I? Or have had Brianna and her wains."
If it had been different. I didn't ask whether he thought his life as it was had been worth the cost. He leaned over and touched my cheek.
"It's worth it, Sassenach," he said. "For me."
I cleared my throat. "For me, too." Ian and Rollo caught us up a few miles from Coriel's ferry. Darkness had fallen, but the glow of the camp was faintly visible against the sky, and we made our way cautiously in, being stopped every quarter mile or so by sentries who popped unnervingly out of the dark, muskets at the ready.
"Friend or foe?"
the sixth of these demanded dramatically, peering at us in the beam of a dark lantern held high.
"General Fraser and his lady,"
Jamie said, shielding his eyes with his hand and glaring down at the sentry.
"Is that friendly enough for you?"
I muffled a smile in my shawl. He'd refused to stop to find food along the way, and I'd refused to let him consume uncooked bacon, no matter how well smoked. Jenny's four apples hadn't gone far. We'd found no food since the night before, and he was starving. An empty stomach generally woke the fiend that slept within, and this was clearly in evidence at the moment.
Yes, sir. General, I only..."
The lantern's beam of light shifted to rest on Rollo, catching him full in the face, and turning his eyes to an eerie green flash. The sentry made a strangled noise, and Ian leaned down from his horse, his own face, mohawk tattoos and all, appearing suddenly in the beam.
"Dinna mind us," he said genially to the sentry. "We're friendly too."
To my surprise, there was actually a good-sized settlement at the ferry, with several inns and substantial houses perched on the bank of the Delaware. "I suppose that's why Washington chose this as the rendezvous point," I asked Jamie. "Good staging, I mean, and some supply."
"Aye, there's that," he said, though he spoke abstractedly.
He'd risen a little in his stirrups, looking over the scene. Every window in every house was lit, but a large American flag, with its circle of stars, flapped above the door of the largest inn. Washington's headquarters, then. My chief concern was to get some food into Jamie before he met with General Lee, if the aforementioned indeed had a reputation for arrogance and short temper. I didn't know what it was about red hair, but many years' experience with Jamie, Brianna, and Jemmy had taught me that while most people became irritable when hungry, a red-headed person with an empty stomach was a walking time bomb.
I sent Ian and Rollo with Jamie to find the quartermaster, discover what we might have in the way of accommodation, and unload the pack mule, then followed my nose toward the nearest scent of food. The dug-in camp kitchens would long since have banked their fires, but I'd been in many army camps and knew how they worked. Small kettles would be simmering all night, filled with stew and porridge for the morning, the more so as the army was in hot pursuit of General Clinton. Amazing to think that I'd met him socially only a few days before. I'd been so focused on my quest that I hadn't seen a man come out of the half-dark and nearly ran into him. He seized me by the arms, and we waltzed a dizzy half-turn before coming to rest.
"Pardon, madame. I'm afraid I've stepped upon your foot,"
said a young French voice, very concerned. And I looked straight into the very concerned face of a very young man. He was in shirt sleeves and breeches, but I could see that his shirt sleeves sported deep lace-trimmed cuffs. An officer, then, in spite of his youth. "Well, yes, you have," I said mildly. "But don't worry about it. I'm not damaged."
"Je suis tellement désolé. Je suis en navet," he exclaimed, striking himself in the forehead.
He wore no wig, and I saw that despite his age, his hair was receding at a rapid pace. What was left of it was red and inclined to stand on end, possibly owing to his apparent habit of thrusting his fingers through it, which he was now doing. "Nonsense," I said in French, laughing. "You aren't a turnip at all."
"Oh, yes," he said, switching to English.
He smiled charmingly at me.
"I once stepped on the foot of the Queen of France. She was much less gracious, Sa Majesty," he added ruefully. "She called me a turnip. Still, if it hadn't happened, I was obliged to leave the court, you know. Perhaps I would never have come to America, so we cannot bemoan my clumsiness altogether, n'est-ce pas?"
He was exceedingly cheerful, and smelled of wine. Not that that was in any way unusual. But given his exceeding Frenchness, his evident wealth, and his tender age, I was beginning to think, have I the, honour of addressing... Bloody hell, what was his actual title? Assuming that he really was...
"Pardon, madame," he exclaimed,
and seizing my hand, bowed low over it and kissed it.
"Marie-Joseph Paul Yves Roche Gilbert du Motier, Marquis de Lafayette, à votre service."
I managed to pick Lafayette out of this torrent of Gallic syllables, and felt the odd little thump of excitement that happened whenever I met someone I knew of from historical accounts, though cold sober realism told me that these people were usually no more remarkable than the people who were cautious or lucky enough not to end up decorating historical accounts with their blood and entrails. I gathered sufficient composure to inform him that I was Madame Générale Fraser, and that I was sure my husband would shortly be along to pay his respects, directly I'd located some supper.
"But you must come and dine with me, madame," he said,
and having not let go of my hand, was in a position to tuck it cosily into his elbow and tow me off toward a large building that looked like an inn of some sort. An inn was precisely what it was, but an inn that had been commandeered by the rebel forces, and was now General Washington's headquarters, as I discovered when Le Marquis led me under a fluttering banner through the tap room and into a large back room where a number of officers were sitting at table, presided over by a large man who didn't look precisely like the image on a dollar bill, but close enough.
"Mon général," the Marquis said, bowing to Washington and then gesturing to me, "I have the honour to present to you, Madame Générale Fraser, the personification of grace and loveliness."
The table rose as one, with a screeching of wooden benches, and the men, in fact, there were only six of them, rose and bowed to me in turn, murmuring, "Your servant," and "Your most obedient, ma'am." Washington himself stood up at the head of the table. "My God, he's as tall as Jamie," I thought, and gave me a very graceful bow, hand on his bosom.
"I am honoured by your presence, Mrs. Fraser," he said in a soft Virginia drawl. Dare I hope that your husband accompanies you?
I had a moment's insane impulse to reply, no, he sent me to fight instead, but managed not to say it.
He does, I replied instead. He's,
I gestured helplessly toward the doorway, where, with remarkably good timing, Jamie himself now appeared, brushing pine needles off his sleeve and saying something to young Ian behind him.
There you are, he exclaimed, spotting me. Someone told me he'd gone off with a strange Frenchman.
What?
He stopped abruptly, having suddenly realized that I wasn't merely in the company of a strange Frenchman. The table fell about laughing, and Lafayette rushed up to Jamie and seized his hand, beaming.
Mon frère d'armes.
He clicked his heels together, doubtless by reflex, and bowed.
I must apologize for having stolen your lovely wife, sir. Allow me, please, to make recompense by inviting you to dinner.
I'd met Anthony Wayne before at Ticonderoga, and was pleased to see him again. I was also delighted to see Dan Morgan, who gave me a hearty buss on both cheeks, and I admitted to a certain thrill at having my hand kissed by George Washington, though noticing the halitosis that accompanied his notorious dental problems. I wonder how I might make an opportunity to inspect his teeth, but gave such speculations up immediately with the arrival of a procession of servants with trays of fried fish, roast chicken, buttermilk biscuits with honey, and an amazing selection of ripe cheeses, these having been, he told me, brought by the Marquis himself from France.
Try this one, he urged me,
cutting a slab of an extremely fragrant Roquefort, green-veined and crumbly. Nathaniel Green, who sat on the other side of the Marquis, pinched his nose unobtrusively and gave me a small private smile. I smiled back, but in fact, I quite liked strong cheese. I wasn't the only one. Rollo, who'd come in naturally with young Ian and was sitting behind him, across the table from me, lifted his head and poked a long, hairy snout between Ian and General Lee, sniffing interestedly at the cheese.
Good Christ!
Lee apparently hadn't noticed the dog before this, and flung himself to one side, nearly ending in Jamie's lap. This action distracted Rollo, who turned to Lee, sniffing him with close attention. I didn't blame the dog. Charles Lee was a tall, thin man with a long, thin nose and the most revolting eating habits I'd seen since Jemmy had learned to feed himself with a spoon. He not only talked while he ate and chewed with his mouth open, but was given to wild gestures while holding things in his hand, with the result that the front of his uniform was streaked with egg, soup, jelly, and a number of less identifiable substances. Despite this, he was an amusing, witty man, and the others seemed to give him a certain deference. I wondered why. Unlike some of the gentlemen at the table, Charles Lee never attained renown as a revolutionary figure. He treated them with a certain... well, it wasn't scorn, certainly. Condescension, perhaps? I was taken up in conversation, mostly with the Marquis, who was putting himself out to be charming to me, telling me how much he missed his wife. Good Lord, how old was he, I wondered. He didn't look more than 20, if that. Who had been responsible for the cheese? No, no, not making it herself, but it came from their estate at Chavagnac, which his wife ran most ably in his absence. But now and then caught a glimpse of Jamie. He took part in the conversation, but I could see his eyes flick round the table, appraising, judging, and they rested most often on General Lee beside him. Of course he knew Wayne and Morgan quite well, and he knew what I'd been able to tell him about Washington and Lafayette. God, I hope what I thought I knew about them was halfway accurate. But we'd find out soon enough if it wasn't. Port wine was brought. Evidently the meal was being hosted by the Marquis. I had the distinct feeling that the high command of the Continental Army didn't always eat this well. The men had largely avoided talking about the impending battle during the meal,
but I could feel the subject looming like an approaching thunderstorm, bright-rimmed black clouds excitingly shot with flickers of lightning. I began to rearrange my skirts and make gestures of incipient leave-taking, and saw Jamie, seated next to Lee across the table, notice and smile at me. Lee noticed too. He'd been gazing in an absent way at my décolletage and broke off the anecdote he'd been telling Ian, seated on his other side.
"Such a pleasure to make your acquaintance, ma'am," he said cordially. "Your husband obliges us extremely by allowing us the delight of your company. I..."
Lee stopped abruptly in mid-sentence and mid-bite, staring at Rollo, who had unobtrusively moved closer and was now standing no more than a couple of feet from the general. Given the low bench on which Lee was sitting and Rollo's size, this proximity placed them roughly eye to eye.
"Why is that dog looking at me like that?" Lee demanded, swinging round to glare at Ian.
"He's waiting to see what you drop next, I expect," Ian said, chewing placidly.
"If I were you, sir," Jamie put in politely, "I'd drop something quickly."
Ian, Rollo and I took our leave of the generals and went out into the dark to find our beds, escorted by an orderly with a lantern. Fires burned high all up and down the bank of the Delaware, and many of the boats on the river had lanterns or open fires as well, the lights reflecting on the water like shoals of glimmering fish.
"Do you know anything about the man who ate beside you?" I asked Ian in my hesitant Gaelic. He laughed. He and Jamie always laughed when I spoke Gaelic, but lifted one shoulder in a negative shrug.
"I do not, but I will find out," he said. "He is an Englishman, I can tell you that much."
He used the word Sassenach, which gave me a mild shock. It had been a long time since I'd heard a Scot use that word in the way it was meant. "Yes, he is. Do you think it makes a difference?"
"Technically, they were all still Englishmen. Well, bar Lafayette, von Steuben, Kosciusko, and similar oddities. But it was true that most of the Continental officers had been born and spent their lives in America."
Lee hadn't. Ian made a derisory Scottish noise indicating that it did.
"But I hear that he was adopted by the Mohawk too," I objected.
Ian was silent for a moment, then took my arm, leaning close to speak in my ear.
"Auntie," he said softly, "do you think I ever stopped being a Scot?"
Chapter 55. Vestal Virgins. Jamie and I were billeted at the home of the Chenoweths, a pleasant, if understandably somewhat anxious family, whose home stood at the end of the single road that ran through Coriel's Ferry. Mrs. Chenoweth was in her wrapper, but greeted me kindly with a candlestick, and took me to a small bedroom at the back of the house, this showing the evidence of hasty evacuation by a number of young Chenoweths, these presumably now sharing their parents' room, judging from the sounds of mixed heavy breathing. The single bed was fairly large, though Jamie's feet would still stick out by a good 6 inches. There was a wash basin and ewer full of fresh water. I picked this up carefully and drank from it. My throat was dry from too much French wine. I replaced the ewer and sat down on the bed, feeling rather strange. Possibly it was the wine. Possibly it was the fact that the room had no windows, and Mrs. Chenoweth had thoughtfully closed the door behind her. It was a small room, perhaps 10 feet by 8. The air was still, and the candle's flame burned high and steady, pure against the bricks of the wall. Perhaps it was the candle that brought to mind Uncle Lamb, and the day he told me about Vestal Virgins, showing me a blue chalcedony carving from the Temple of Vesta.
"Should a virgin betray her vows," he'd said, waggling his eyebrows at me, "she'd be whipped, then sealed up alive in a small underground tomb, equipped with a table and chair, some water, and a single candle. And there she would die, when the air ran out."
I'd considered that with a sort of morbid relish. I might have been 10, and then asked with interest just how a Vestal might betray her vows. Which is how I learned what used to be called the facts of life. Uncle Lamb not being one to shirk any fact that wandered across his path, or mine. And while Uncle Lamb had assured me that the cult of Vesta had long since ceased operations, I had at that point resolved not to be a virgin, just in case. On the whole, a good resolution, though sleeping with men did have the most peculiar side effects. Ian had brought along my saddlebags, which he'd dumped in the corner of the room before going off with Rollo to find his own sleeping place. I got up and fumbled for my toothbrush and tooth powder, though it seemed quite surreal to be brushing my teeth on what might be the eve of battle. Not quite rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Or at least I hope not. I knew that Washington and the Marquis were going to survive whatever happened, and spared a thought for the strangeness of now thinking of them as men and not names. The large pores on George Washington's nose as he bent over my hand, and the shadowed pits of old smallpox scars across his lower cheeks. The smell of him, starch and sweat, wine and wig powder, for he wore his wig, hot as it was. The sweetly nasty smell of dental decay. I picked up my toothbrush, reminded, and set to work with some vigour. He'd smelt of blood, too. I wondered why. Bleeding gums, perhaps? I wriggled my way out of gown, jacket, and stays, and stood for a bit, flapping my shift in hopes of admitting a little air. It made the candle flicker, but didn't have much effect beyond that. So I blew the candle out and lay down. I didn't expect to sleep. Adrenaline had been jolting through me like the current in a faulty circuit ever since we'd left Philadelphia. But now it was settling down to a steady humming in my blood. The conversation over dinner had been fairly general, but the atmosphere had been electric with anticipation. Clearly, once Ian and I had left, and the plates had been removed, it was as close as I had ever been to a council of war, and the vibrations of it were still tingling through me. There was anxiety tingling too, to be sure. There had been amongst the men as well. But given a suitable outlet, anxiety can be transformed into very effective action, and that's plainly what Washington and his generals were now doing, hammering out plans, assigning troops, drawing up strategies. I wished I was amongst them. It would be much easier than lying in the pitch dark, staring up into a boring infinity. Nasty way to die, that. I sat up, gulping air, and went hastily to the door. No sounds, no light seeping under the door. I patted around on the floor till I located my shoes and the puddle of my cloak, and swinging this over my shoulders, slipped out and made my way silently through the half-dark house, past the smouldering hearth, and out. The door was unbolted and on the latch. Perhaps Mr. Chenoweth was out and expected back. I supposed there was some danger of my being locked out, but at this point spending the night in the midst of a military camp in my shift seemed preferable to sleeping, or rather, not sleeping, in a tomb. Besides, I was sure that one of the small Chenoweths had weed in the bed fairly recently. No one took any notice of me as I walked back along the road. The taverns and ordinaries were crammed full and spilling customers all over the road. Continental regulars in their blue and buff swaggering about. The envy, they hoped, of the militiamen. Any number of women, too. And not all whores by any means. But above all, air. The heat of the day had largely gone, and while the air wasn't cold by any means, it wasn't stifling either. Having escaped entombment, I revelled in the feeling of freedom, and what amounted to invisibility, for tall as I was, with my cloak on, and my hair tied back in a plait for bed, I looked much like many of the militiamen in the dark. No one glanced twice at me. The street and the camp beyond were electric. I recognised the feeling, and it gave me the oddest sense of dislocation, for I recognized it in its various forms from half of the battlefields I'd served near, from France in 1944 to Preston Pans and Saratoga. It wasn't always this way. Often the sense of the occasion was one of dread, or worse. I remember the night before Culloden, and felt a wave of cold wash through me so strongly that I staggered and nearly fell against the wall of a building.
"Friend Claire?" said a voice in amazement.
"Denzel?"
Half-blinded by a number of torches being borne past, I blinked at the shape that had manifested before me.
"What is he doing out here?" he said, alarmed. "Is anything wrong? Is it Jamie?"
"Well, you could say it's Jamie," I said, getting back my composure. "But there's nothing wrong, no. I was just getting a bit of air. What are you doing here?"
"I was fetching a pitcher of beer," he said,
and took me firmly by the arm, steering me down the street.
"Come with me. They ought not to be in the street with the fighting men. Those that aren't drunk now will be shortly."
I didn't argue. His hand on my arm felt good, steadying me against the strange currents of the night that seemed to carry me willy-nilly into the past and the future, and back again without warning.
"Where are Rachel and Dottie?" I asked, as we turned right at the end of the street and began to thread our way through the campfires and rows of tents.
"Rachel's gone somewhere with Ian. I didn't inquire. Dottie's in our medical tent dealing with a case of acute indigestion."
"Oh, dear. What did she eat?"
He laughed softly.
"The indigestion isn't hers. A woman named Peabody, who came in complaining of colic pains. Dorothea said she would administer something appropriate if I would go and fetch her some beer, it not being safer to venture to the ordinary alone."
I thought I detected a small note of reproach in his voice, but I made an indeterminate "hmm" in response, and he said no more about my wandering the streets en déshabille, possibly because he hadn't noticed that I was en déshabille, until we entered the hunter's big medical tent and I took my cloak off. Denny gave me one brief shocked look, coughed, and picking up a canvas apron, managed to hand it to me without looking directly at me. Dottie, who was massaging the massive back of a very large woman seated hunched over on a stool in front of her, grinned at me over the woman's capped head.
"How are you, Auntie? Restless tonight?"
"Very," I replied frankly, putting on the apron.
"This is Mrs. Peabody?"
"Yes."
Dottie smothered a yawn with her shoulder.
"The indigestion seems to be better. I gave her gripe water and peppermint," she added to Denny, "but she's complaining of pains in her back as well."
"Hmm."
I came over and squatted down in front of the woman, who appeared to be half asleep, until I caught a whiff of her breath, which was 80 proof at least. I put my hand on her belly to see if I could feel the location of the trouble, when she coughed thickly in a way I'd heard all too often before, choked, and I leapt back just in time.
"Thank you for the apron, Denny," I said mildly,
brushing off some of the higher flecks of mud and vomit that had spattered on me.
"I don't suppose you brought a birthing stool with you?"
"A birthing stool? To a battle?"
he said faintly, his eyes bulging slightly behind his spectacles as he looked at the woman, now swaying ponderously to and fro, like a large bell making up its mind whether to ring or not.
"I rather think it may be one," I said, glancing round, "if she's in labour. Can you find a blanket, Dottie? I think we'll have to lay her on the ground. She'll collapse the cot."
It took all three of us to wrestle Mrs. Peabody, who relapsed comfortably into unconsciousness the moment we touched her, onto a blanket spread on the ground under the lantern. There was an almost instant insurgence of moths as they came fluttering in, attracted not only by the light, but by the assorted smells thickening the air. Mrs. Peabody had lapsed not merely into unconsciousness, but into what appeared to be an alcoholic coma. After a certain amount of discussion, we turned her onto one side in case she should vomit again, and the position had allowed her belly to flow away from the rest of her corpulent body,
so that it lay on the ground in front of her, gravid and sack-like. She looked like the queen of some order of social insect, ready to deliver in the thousands. But I refrained from mentioning this, as Dotty was still pale. Denzel had recovered from the shock and was keeping an eye, or rather a hand, on her wrist, keeping track of her pulse. "Amazingly strong," he said at last, letting go and looked up at me. "Does thee think she is near her time?" "I really hope not," I said, looking down. "But there's no telling without, closer examination." I took a deep breath and a grip on my more generous instincts. "Would you like me to,
"I'll go and find clean water," he said, springing to his feet and seizing a bucket.
Given that Dotty was engaged to Denny, I refrained from calling him a coward in her presence, and merely waved him off in a reserved manner. Mrs. Peabody made me uneasy on a number of scores. I had no idea whether she might be about to go into labour, or if she did, how her comatose state might affect it. The level of alcohol in her blood was certainly affecting the child's. Would a drunken newborn be able to breathe? It wouldn't vomit, as there wasn't anything in its stomach to vomit. But might it void its bowels in utero and aspirate the material? That was a remarkably dangerous thing to happen, even in a modern hospital with a full delivery suite staff attending. Most of the babies who did that died of suffocation, lung injury, or infection. I was very much ashamed to admit to myself that my chief fear, though, was that something would happen during delivery that would require me to remain with mother and, or child, for a prolonged period. I could not, by my oath as a physician, and what I conceived my responsibilities to be, abandon a patient in dire need of me. But I would not abandon Jamie. I knew beyond all doubt that he was going into battle, and soon. He wasn't going without me. A slight noise jerked me out of my hypothetical moral quandary. Dotty had started unpacking and had dropped an amputation saw. She stooped to pick it up and said something under her breath in German that I thought was probably a bad word. John always swore in German. Perhaps it was a family habit. Thought of John added another layer of guilt to my complicated feelings, though the logical part of my brain firmly rejected this as undeserved. Still, the worry for him couldn't be rejected so easily, though I did my best to tuck it away for the present. "You needn't stay up, Dotty," I said. "I can take care of matters here. Nothing's going to happen immediately, regardless. I can make up the surgical kits."
"No, that's all right," she said, and then yawned involuntarily, gaping so widely that she startled herself and clapped a hand belatedly over her mouth. "Oh, dear, I do beg your pardon, Mrs. Fraser." That made me smile. She had John's elegant manners. Perhaps Hal did too, when he wasn't engaging in undiluted bastardliness. "Actually," she said, fixing me directly with her striking gaze, "I'm pleased to have a chance to talk with you in privacy."
"Oh," I said, squatting to put a hand on Mrs. Peabody's belly.
I wasn't feeling any movement from the baby, but they usually did go quiet if labour was impending. I could have used my stethoscope to listen for a fetal heartbeat, but it was in one of the boxes or bags that Ian and the orderly had carried off somewhere. Besides, whatever I heard or didn't would make no difference to the immediate protocol.
"Yes."
Dotty sat down on a packing case, as though it were a throne. Like all the Greys I'd met, she had excellent posture.
"I want to know the correct way of performing sexual intercourse."
"Oh,
She glanced down at Mrs. Peabody. "And whether there is any way of preventing,
pregnancy?" "To be sure."
I cleared my throat. I rather thought the sight of Mrs. Peabody would have put most young women off the idea of childbearing, if not sex, altogether. Dorothea Gray, though, was plainly a young woman of blood and iron.
Don't mistake me, Auntie, she said earnestly. Or do I mean friend Claire? I do want children, and want them terribly. But if there is any choice about giving birth on a battlefield or a moving ship, say...
I seized on this last, in part to give myself time to compose something coherent in the way of advice. I'd rather thought Rachel might want to talk about such things at some point, having no mother, but...
A ship? Are you thinking of going home to England, then?
She grimaced in a way that brought her father vividly before me, and I nearly laughed, but fortunately didn't.
I don't know. I dearly want to see Mama again, of course, and Adam, and my... Well, actually, I doubt I should see any of my friends again.
She waved a hand, dismissing the friends.
Not that there aren't any Quakers in society, but they're all very rich, and we won't be.
She bit her lip, but in a way indicating calculation rather than chagrin.
If I can contrive to make Denny marry me here, so that we arrive in England as husband and wife already, it would be a simple matter to find a London meeting that would welcome us. Whereas here...
She flung out a hand toward the hum of the camp around us.
His involvement in the war would always stand in his way, you see.
Even after the war is over. She gave me a patient look, too old for her face.
Papa says that wars take 3 generations to fade from the ground where they're fought. And from what I've seen, friends have quite long memories as well.
He might just have a point. Mrs. Peabody had begun to snore wetly, but I felt no sense of contraction. I rubbed a hand through my hair and braced my back more comfortably against one of the packing crates set against the wall.
All right. Perhaps a little basic anatomy to begin with?
I really had no idea how much, if anything, a nobly born young woman might have been told or found out by other means, so began with female reproductive anatomy, starting with the womb, for surely she knew what that was, and leading outward part by part.
"You mean it has a name?"
she exclaimed, charmed, when I got to the clitoris.
"I'd always thought of it as just, you know, that bit."
Her tone of voice made it abundantly clear that I needn't explain what that bit did, and I laughed. To the best of my knowledge, it's the only structure of the human body that appears to have no function whatever, save the pleasure of the owner.
"But men, do they..."
"Well, yes, they do," I said. "And very pleasurable they find theirs, too. But a penis is extremely functional as well. You,
do know how it works,
in terms of intercourse?"
"Denzel won't let me touch his naked member, and I'm longing to see it at my leisure, not just the odd glimpse when he... Well, you know."
Her eyes sparkled at the thought.
"But I know what it feels like through his britches. I was amazed the first time it went stiff under my hand. How does it do that?"
I explained the concept of hydrostatic pressure as simply as possible, already seeing what was coming next. I cleared my throat and rose to my knees. "I need to examine Mrs. Peabody for any sign of labour. And while we must be respectful of her privacy..." "So far as such a thing exists under these conditions," for Dotty had snorted loudly.
"Since you're assisting me here, there's no reason why you shouldn't observe what I'm doing, and I'll explain it to you as we go, how things work."
She hummed with interest as I gingerly unveiled Mrs. Peabody's nether regions, which were thickly forested, but still identifiably, very identifiably, feminine. "When the cervix, that's the opening to the womb, when it begins to open in order for the baby to come out, there's often some blood and mucus released, but it's quite harmless. I don't see any sign of it yet, though." That heartened me.
"Oh," said Dotty, rather faintly. But she leaned intently over my shoulder as I carefully inserted my freshly washed hand. "Oh," Dotty said, in tones of extreme revelation.
That's where it goes.
Well, yes, it is, I said, trying not to laugh, and failing. Denzel would have told you, I expect. Did you ask him?
No,
she said, sitting back a little on her heels, but still watching closely as I put a hand on Mrs. Peabody's abdomen and felt the cervix. Softened, but still firm. I began to breathe again. No, I said, only half attending.
No,
she drew herself up.
I didn't want to seem ignorant. Denny's so... I mean, he's educated.
I can read, of course, and write, but only letters and play music, but that's useless. I bustle round after him and help where I can, of course, and he's always so good about explaining things. But, well, I kept having this vision of our wedding night and him explaining it to me in just the same way he'd tell me how to suck the snot out of a child's nose with a tube, or hold the skin together so he could stitch a wound, and... She made a graceful little moo, which had to be her mother's legacy. And I made up my mind it wasn't going to be that way.
Very, commendable.
I withdrew my hand and wiped it, recovered Mrs. Peabody, and checked her pulse again. Slow but strong as a timpani. The woman must have the heart of an ox.
How do you want it to be?
Bearing in mind, I hasten to add, that this sort of thing is rather variable. Another thought occurred to me. Has Denzel ever...
Though I don't suppose you know.
Her soft white brow wrinkled in thought. I don't know. I never thought of asking him. I just assumed... Well, I have brothers. I know they have, because they talk about it. Whores, I mean, with their friends. I suppose I thought all men... But come to think, perhaps Denny wouldn't go to a prostitute. Do you think he might have?
Her brow furrowed a little, but she didn't seem upset at the thought. Of course, it was probably commonly accepted in the Grey's social circle that men, or soldiers at least, naturally would.
With very vivid memories of my own wedding night... And my stupefaction upon being informed that my bridegroom was a virgin? I temporized a bit. Possibly not. Now, being a medical man, plainly he must know the essential mechanics. But there is more to it than that. Her eyes grew brighter, and she leaned forward, hands on her knees.
Tell me.
Rather like egg white mixed with a drop or two of civet. Theoretically good for the skin, though frankly, I was saying, when I heard the sound of voices just outside the tent. Rachel and Ian had returned, looking cheerful, flushed, and quite like young people who had just passed the last hour or two doing the sorts of things in which I'd been instructing Dotty. I saw her glance sideways at Rachel, then very briefly at Ian's breeches. Her colour went up a notch. Rachel didn't notice, her attention having fixed at once on Mrs. Peabody. Well, everyone's attention was fixed on Mrs. Peabody. It was really impossible to look at anything else. She frowned at the supine woman on the ground and then looked at me.
Where's Denzel?
An excellent question. He left a quarter of an hour ago to find water. There's beer, though, if you're thirsty. I nodded at the neglected pitcher. Ian poured a cup for Rachel, waited while she drank it, then refilled it for himself, eyes still fixed on Mrs. Peabody, who was emitting a remarkable variety of noises, though still out cold.
"Does Uncle Jimmy ken where you are, Auntie?" he asked. "He was looking for you just now. He said he'd put you somewhere safe to sleep, but you'd escaped."
"Again?" he added with a broad grin.
"Oh," I said. "He's finished with the generals for the night, then?"
"Aye.
He went to meet the acquaintance of some of the militia captains under him, but most had gone to sleep by then, so he went to join ye at the Chenoweth's."
"Mrs. Chenoweth was a bit taken aback to find you gone," he added delicately.
"I just came out for a little air," I said, defensive, "and then..." I gestured at the patient on the floor, who had now settled down to a rhythmic snore. Her colour was looking better. That was heartening.
Is Jamie put out, do you think?
Ian and Rachel both laughed at that.
No, auntie, Ian said. But he's dead tired, and he wants you bad.
Did he tell you to say that?
Not in precisely those words, Rachel said, but his meaning was plain.
She turned to Ian with a quick squeeze of his arm.
Would he go and find Denny, Ian? Claire can't leave this woman alone,
I think, she asked, arching a brow at me. Not yet, I said. She doesn't seem to be going into labour immediately. I crossed my fingers against the possibility, but she oughtn't to be left alone in this state.
Of course.
Ian yawned suddenly, widely, but then shook himself back into alertness.
If I come across Uncle Jimmy, I'll tell him where you are, Auntie.
He left, and Rachel poured another cup of beer, which she offered me. It was room temperature, and a warm room at that, but refreshingly sour and strong. I hadn't really thought I was tired, but the beer revivified me astonishingly. Dotty, having checked Mrs. Peabody's pulse and breathing, laid a ginger hand on the distended bulge of pregnancy.
"Has thee attended a birth before, good sister?"
Dotty asked Rachel, being careful of her plain speech.
"Several," Rachel replied, squatting down by Mrs. Peabody. "This looks somewhat different, though. Has she suffered some injury?" "Oh!"
The brewery reek hit her, and she reared back and coughed.
"I see."
Mrs. Peabody uttered a loud moan, and everyone stiffened. I wiped my hands on my apron just in case. She relaxed again, though, and after a few moments' contemplative silence to see if Mrs. Peabody would do it again, Dotty took a deep breath.
Friend Claire was just telling me some very interesting things regarding, what to expect on one's wedding night.
Rachel looked up with interest.
I should welcome any such instruction myself. I know where the parts go, because I've seen them go there fairly frequently, but...
You have? Dotty gawked at her, and Rachel laughed.
I have. But Ian assures me that he has more skill than the average bull or billy goat, and my observations are limited to the animal world, I'm afraid.
A small line showed between her brows.
The woman who cared for me after the death of my parents was very dutiful in informing me of my womanly obligations, but her instructions consisted largely of spread thy legs, grit thy teeth, girl, and let him.
I sat down on the packing case and stretched to ease my back, suppressing a groan. God knew how long it might take Ian to find Jamie among the teeming hordes. And I did hope that Denny hadn't been knocked on the head or trampled by a mule.
Pour me another cup of beer, will you?
And have some more yourselves. I suspect we may need it. And if he says,
oh God,
at some point, I advised, take note of what you were just doing, so you can do it again next time. Rachel laughed, but Dotty frowned a little, looking slightly cross-eyed.
Does thee think Denny would take the Lord's name in vain, even under those circumstances?
I've heard him do it on much less provocation than that, Rachel assured her, stifling a burp with the back of her hand.
He tries to be perfect in thy company, thee knows, for fear thee will change thy mind.
He does? Dotty looked surprised, but rather pleased.
Oh, I wouldn't, thee knows. Ought I to tell him?
Not until he says, oh God for thee, Rachel said, succumbing to a giggle. I wouldn't worry, I said. If a man says, oh God, in that situation, he nearly always means it as a prayer.
Dotty's fair brows drew together in concentration. A prayer of desperation? Or gratitude?
Well, that's up to you, I said, and stifled a small belch of my own.
Approaching male voices outside the tent made us all glance self-consciously at the empty beer pitcher and sit up straight, poking at our slightly dishevelled hair. But none of the gentlemen who came in were in any condition to cast stones. Ian had found Denzel and Jamie, and somewhere along the way they had acquired a small stout companion in a cocked hat, with his hair in a stumpy pigtail. All of them were flushed, and, while certainly not staggering, were surrounded by a distinct haze of fermented barleycorn.
"There ya, Sassenach."
Jamie brightened still further at seeing me, and I felt a small rush of delight at it.
"Are ye... who's this?"
He had been advancing toward me, hand outstretched, but stopped abruptly at sight of Mrs. Peabody, who was lying with her arms flung out, mouth wide open.
"That's the lady I told you about, Uncle Jamie."
Ian wasn't staggering either, but was distinctly swaying, and took hold of the tent pole to steady himself.
"The one that's,
He gestured with his free hand to the gentleman in the cocked hat.
"She's his wife."
"Oh? Aye, I see." He edged gingerly around Mrs. Peabody's recumbent form.
"She's no dead, is she?"
"No," I said. "I think I would have noticed." He might have been somewhat inebriated, but still caught the faint dubious emphasis I placed on think. He knelt down carefully and put a hand in front of her open mouth.
"Nay, only drunk," he said cheerfully. "Shall we lend ye a hand to take her home, Mr. Peabody?"
"Better lend him a wheelbarrow,"
Dotty whispered to Rachel beside her, but luckily no one noticed.
"That would be kindly of you, sir."
Surprisingly, Mr. Peabody appeared to be the only sober one of the lot. He knelt and smoothed the damp hair tenderly off his wife's brow.
"Lulu, wake up, darling. Time to be going now."
To my surprise, she opened her eyes, and after blinking several times in confusion, appeared to fix her gaze on her husband.
"There you are, Simon," she said,
and with a rapturous smile, fell soundly back asleep. Jamie rose slowly, and I could hear the small bones in his back pop as he eased himself. He was still flushed and smiling, but Ian had been right. He was dead tired. I could see the deep lines of weariness in his face and the hollows under his bones. Ian saw them too.
"Auntie Claire's in need of her bed, Uncle Jamie," he said, squeezing Jamie's shoulder and giving me a meaning look. "It's been a long night for her." "Take her along, aye? Denny and I can help Mr. Peabody."
Jamie gave his nephew a sharp look, and then turned the same look on me, but I obligingly yawned widely enough to make my jaw crack. No great effort. And with a final quick look at Mrs. Peabody, to be sure she was neither dying nor going into labour, I took his arm and towed him determinedly outside, waving briefly in farewell. Outside, we both drew deep breaths of fresh air, sighed in unison, and laughed. "It has been rather a long night, hasn't it?" I put my forehead against his chest and my arms around him, slowly rubbing the knobs of his vertebrae through his coat. "What happened?" He sighed again and kissed the top of my head.
"I've command of 10 companies of mixed militia from Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The Marquis has command of 1,000 men, including mine, and is in charge of a plan to go and bite the British army in the arse."
"Sounds like fun." The racket of the camp had died down considerably, but the thick air still held the vibrations of many men, awake or uneasily asleep. I thought I could feel the same expectant vibration pass through Jamie in spite of his obvious tiredness.
"You need sleep, then."
His arm tightened round me, and his free hand travelled slowly down my back. I had left Denny's apron in the tent, and my cloak was over my arm. The thin muslin of my shift might as well have not existed.
"Oh, God,"
he said, and his big warm hand cupped my buttock with a sudden urgency.
I need you, Sassanach. I need you bad.
The shift was just as thin in front as in back. I could feel his waistcoat buttons, and a few other things through it. He did want me bad. Do you mind doing it in a crypt that smells of wee? I asked, thinking of the Chenoweth's back bedroom.
I've taken you in worse places, Sassanach.
Before I could say, name three, the tent flap opened to disgorge a small procession, this consisting of Denzel, Dotty, Rachel, and Ian, each couple carrying one end of a canvas sheet on which lay the protuberant form of Mrs. Peabody. Mr. Peabody led the way, lantern held high. We were standing in shadow, and they passed without noticing us, the girls giggling at the occasional stumble, the young men grunting with effort, and Mr. Peabody calling out encouragement as they made their laborious way through the darkness, presumably heading for the Peabody abode. The tent stood before us, dark and invitingly empty.
Aye.
Oh, yes. The stretcher-bearers had taken the lantern, and the setting moon was the barest sliver above the horizon. The inside of the tent was filled with a soft, dusty black that rose up around us in a fragrantly alcoholic cloud, with a faint tang of vomit, when we stepped inside. I recalled exactly where things were, though, and we managed to push together four of the packing crates. I spread my cloak on these. He took off his coat and waistcoat, and we lay down precariously in the beery dark together. How long do you think we have? I asked, undoing his flies. His flesh was warm and hard under my hand, and his skin there, soft as polished silk.
Long enough, he said,
and brushed my nipple with his thumb, slowly, in spite of his own apparent urgency.
Then hurry yourself, Sassanach. There's no telling when we'll have the chance again.
He kissed me lingeringly, his mouth tasting of Roquefort and port. I could feel the vibration of the camp here, too. It ran through both of us like a fiddle string pegged tight.
I dinna think I've got time to make you scream, Sassanach, he whispered in my ear. But I've maybe time to make you moan.
Well, possibly. It's some time till dawn, isn't it? Whether it was the beer and premarital explanations, the late hour and lure of secrecy, or only Jamie himself and our increasing need to shut out the world and know only each other, he had time and to spare.
Oh, God,
he said at last, and came down slowly on me, his heart beating heavy against my ribs.
Oh, God.
I felt my own pulse throb in hands and bones and centre, but couldn't manage any response more eloquent than a faint, ooh. After a bit, though, I recovered enough to stroke his hair. We'll go home again soon, I whispered to him, and have all the time in the world. That got me a softly affirmative Scottish noise, and we lay there for a bit longer, not wanting to come apart and get dressed, though the packing cases were hard, and the possibility of discovery increasing with each passing minute. At last he stirred, but not to rise.
Oh, God, he said softly, in another tone altogether. 300 men.
And held me tighter. Chapter 56. Stinking Papist. The sun wasn't yet above the horizon, but the horse park was busy as an anthill, full of grooms, foragers, teamsters, and farriers, all scurrying about their business in an incongruous soft pink light, filled with the sound of hundreds of pairs of steadily champing jaws. William picked up the bay gelding's hoof and held out his hand for the hoof pick. His new small groom was clutching nervously to his chest.
Now come here, Zeb, he said coaxingly. I'll show you how it's done. There's nothing to it.
Yes, sir.
Zebedee Jeffers edged an inch closer, eyes flicking back and forth from the hoof to the towering mass of horse flesh. Jeffers didn't like horses. He particularly didn't like Visigoth. William thought it was just as well that Zeb didn't likely know what a Visigoth was. All right. See there? He tapped a pick against the shadow, the edge of a small rock that had trapped itself under the curve of the iron shoe during the night. It's only a little one, but it feels just like a pebble in your own shoe would feel, and he'll go lame if we don't take care of it. Here, it's not stuck fast. Do you want to try?
No, sir, Zeb said honestly.
Zebedee came from the shore of Maryland and knew about oysters, boats, and fish, not horses. He won't hurt you, William said with a touch of impatience. He'd been riding back and forth along the columns a dozen times a day, carrying dispatches and gathering reports. Both his horses needed to be kept ready. His regular groom, Colenso Baragwanath, was down with a fever, and he hadn't time to find another servant.
Yes, he will, sir, Zeb added as an afterthought. See?
He held out a scrawny arm, displaying what was undoubtedly a festering bite mark. William suppressed the urge to ask what the devil the boy had been doing to the horse. Visigoth wasn't a bad-tempered horse on the whole, but he could be irritable, and Zeb's nervous fidgeting was enough to try anyone, let alone a tired and hungry horse. All right, he said with a sigh, and pried the rock loose with one sharp dig. Better then, he said to the horse, running a hand down the leg and then patting Goth's flank. He felt in his pocket and drew out a bunch of limp carrots, bought the night before from a farm woman who'd come through camp with baskets of produce on a yoke across her broad shoulders. Here, give him that. Make friends with him, he suggested, handing a carrot to Zeb. Hold it flat on your hand. Before the boy could extend this putative olive branch, though, the horse reached down and snatched it from his fingers with an audible crunch of big yellow teeth. The boy uttered a small shriek and took several steps back, collided with a bucket, and fell over it, arse over tea kettle. Torn between annoyance and an unseemly urge to laugh, William smothered both and went to pick his groom out of a manure pile. "Tell you what," he said, dusting the boy off with a firm hand, "you see that all my dunnage is aboard the baggage wagon. See if Colenso needs anything. And make sure there's something for me to eat tonight. I'll ask Sutherland's groom to tend the horses."
Zeb sagged with relief. "Thank you, sir."
"And go see one of the surgeons and have that arm tended to," William shouted after him, above the rising sound of braying and whickering. The boy's shoulders rose up around his ears, and he walked faster, pretending he hadn't heard. William saddled Goth himself. He always did, not trusting anyone else to check tack that his life might depend on, then left him with his other horse, Madras, and went to find Lord Sutherland's groom. Despite the bustle, he had no trouble finding the string. Sutherland had 10 horses, all prime creatures of 16 hands or so, and at least a dozen grooms to tend them. William was just concluding negotiations with one of these when he caught sight of a familiar face among the throng. "Shit," he said under his breath, but Captain Richardson had seen him and was coming toward him, smiling genially.
"Captain Lord Ellesmere, your servant, sir."
"Yours, sir," William said as pleasantly as he could. What did the scoundrel want now, he wondered. Not that Richardson was a scoundrel, or not necessarily one, despite Randall's warning. It might, after all, be Randall who was the scoundrel,